Welcome back to On the Fly. I'm Mark Dowie. I'm talking today with economist Robert Reich, author of many articles and books, the latest being Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future.
Bob, I'd like to walk you into a coffee shop in Madison, Wisconsin, where you'd be the only person there who is not a public employee. They're taking a very long coffee break. They recognize you as the former Secretary of Labor, and they come over and ask you, what should we do? What would you answer?
You mean if they are public employees today?
Yeah, state and public, yes,
you mean
in
they
Wisconsin.
They're in a terribly difficult spot. I would say hold out. I would say fight, but bring other allies with you. I would say to you, I would say to them, if they are the only people there and there are no other private sector union people, no other citizens who are concerned about what's going on, they better damn quick get other people to join their ranks. What's happening in Wisconsin is really just one of the early stages of what can only be described, Mark, as class warfare. The Republicans have sought to get rid of public employee unions for years. They have sought with a great deal of success to get rid of private employee unions for even longer. What's going on in Wisconsin right now is a testing ground for Republican governors to see how far they can go in getting rid of collective bargaining rights. Look, the story is and should be about power. This is what's going on in Wisconsin. It's not about wage concessions or benefit concessions because the employees, state employees, have already offered them. This is about who has the power. And it's really about the middle class because the public employees are the same middle class people, basically, as private workers in the private sector whose pay and benefits and jobs are all threatened. Governor Walker has been giving away tax benefits to corporations and to the wealthy. That's not being talked about. Well, I think that public employees ought to be talking about that.
So now I'm going to put you back in the cabinet and have the president call you and say the union movement is melting down in America. There's major assault, probably just starting. Could get much worse. What should we do? What should the government do now? And so you're advising from the position of Secretary of Labor. What would you do if you were there?
I'd be very clear, Mr. President. First of all, make sure that the Employee Free Choice Act or something like that gets passed immediately because it's very difficult to organize a union in this country right now. Employers use every possible technique that they have to intimidate workers who want to organize a union, threaten them with losing their jobs. This is illegal under the law, under the 1935 Wagner Act, but they do it anyway because the penalty is basically a slap on the wrist. At the very worst, employees who have been intimidated or fired for trying to organize a union are given back pay and reinstated by the National Labor Relations Board after years have gone by. Mr. President, you've got to raise the penalties for employers that violate labor laws. This is not just about unionized workers. This is about the entire structure of our labor force because the median wage has stagnated for 30 years, even though the American economy is twice as large as it was 30 years ago. Mr. President, we're talking about not just jobs, but we're talking about people's livelihoods in this country.
You talk a lot in your speeches, lectures, and interviews about ideological fixations. What exactly do you mean by ideological fixations? So which are the ones that are most in our way?
Well, the biggest ideological fixation is the one that was promulgated by Milton Friedman and Barry Goldwater and others is still with us, that government is bad, that the public sector sort of intervenes. They use that word, intervenes, in this marvelous free market. I'll tell you something. There is no such thing as a free market in a state of nature. It's wild. It's brutal. It's nasty. It's a dog-eat-dog. It's survival of the fittest. I mean, without government, we don't have a market. We don't have order. Without government, we don't even know what private property is, and we certainly don't have any way of enforcing contracts or property or liability. Without government, we can't have patents. We don't have inventions. Without government, how do we educate people or provide any kind of social insurance at all, or build roads and bridges, or have national defense? I mean, this whole edifice of ideology that somehow there are markets out there and it's either government or market is one of the crassest and most fictitious ideological fixations ever created. And you see, the progressives and liberals really don't have not figured out how to counter it. Milton Friedman was so clever and was so convincing and was so worshipped by other economists, certainly after the stagflation of the 1970s, that there was no alternative. There has not been any sharp, strong alternative.
The individual mandate is something that you've paid some attention to, the part of the healthcare bill. Do you think it's possible to reform healthcare as the bill is structured now without the individual mandate?
No, you've got to have the individual mandate because that provides the pool of healthy and younger people. You need to offset the increased costs of people with pre-existing conditions who are older or less healthy, who are going to be included. Without the younger and healthier people, the costs per insured just skyrocket. And so you've got to do it all together. This is a great irony, Mark, because you see, many of us from the beginning said to the Democrats and Obama and anybody who would listen, you've got to do this on the same model that you did Medicare and Social Security, using the payroll tax system and having a kind of expanded Medicare for all. But, of course, the conservatives would hear nothing of that. Republicans, they couldn't get a single vote for that, even on a Medicare option. So now we are in the bizarre position where you've got the courts and the public, a majority of the public, saying, we don't like this individual mandate. Well, they don't like the individual mandate because the individual mandate is premised on a system that was not sustainable to begin with. If this had been instead premised on Social Security and Medicare and payroll taxes, people would not complain about having to pay. In fact, people love Social Security. They love Medicare. In fact, try to take away Social Security or Medicare, people scream. That's the model that we should base our health care system on.
Do you think the individual mandate will survive?
I'm afraid it will be eroded. I mean, even today, the president said that he would allow states waivers from the individual mandate and, in fact, waivers going even beyond that. Once you start with waivers, once you allow people to opt out of the individual mandate, then the whole edifice begins coming apart. Because, as I said, you can't afford to insure against pre-existing conditions or chronic high-cost medical problems.
You served in the United States government under three administrations. Any regrets? Any decisions you wish you had made differently or advice you'd given differently?
Well, I always, always regret, as I look back on any position I've ever held, not doing more, compromising a bit too much on certain issues. I mean, I think the Family Medical Act was the right thing to do. I'm glad we won. I think we implemented it well. I think the pension reform legislation that we got through and the sweatshop campaign that we initiated and a lot of the other things we did were definitely in the right direction. But, Mark, I wish I had been able to persuade the Democrats and President Clinton that the middle class was threatened, that even though it looked as though in the 1995, 1996 period, the economy was roaring back and jobs and wages were coming back, that this was just a cyclical phenomenon. I wish I had been able to persuade more people that the underlying structure of the economy was still tilted against the middle class, the working class, and the poor.
You're listening to economist Robert Reich on the fly with Mark Dowie. Join me for the final part of our conversation, where we'll be talking about optimism in America's progressive history.
Most people these days are offended by racist or anti-Semitic or sexist comments. I mean, think of the progress politically and sociologically that that represents.
That's Robert Reich on the fly with Mark Dowie.